course, I read a lot, and while I wasn't doing much digital, I was reading about, and I didn't, like you're saying that a lot of people believe that it was a passing phase. I knew it wasn't. Not to say that I understood it very well, but I've also, you know, I'm also an amateur actor, and I've done stuff in front of a camera. So I think that English Nut came together as a thing which A, allowed me to do stuff about the English language, which is a passion. Do something with video, which was the future. Do something which involved being in front of the camera in some way. So that's my narcissistic side, I guess.
Some of the most interesting conversations happen over a cup of coffee. And there are many people doing really interesting and cool things with their lives. You can't have coffee with all of them, but you might just be able to interview some of them. That's why I started this podcast, to have conversations with people I find interesting. I'm your host, Pawan, and welcome to Coffee by Two, a place where interesting conversations happen over a podcast. My guest on this episode of the Coffee by Two podcast is Sumanto Chattopadhyaya, one of India's most well-respected creative directors, who also moonlights as the English Nut. In this episode, we'll speak about how he got started in advertising, his journey at one of India's most storied agencies, the birth of the English Nut, and how he got to interview the likes of Ruskin Bond and Shashi Tharoor. Welcome to the show, Sumanto.
Hi, Pawan. It's lovely to be talking to you on your podcast, Coffee by Two. I was quite intrigued by the name, and while I believe that it's based on a Bangalore concept of sharing one coffee between two people, I would never do that because I'm a coffee addict, and I would never split my coffee with anybody else. But thank you very much.
Yeah. So thanks, Sumanto. I mean, I must say that I've followed your career from afar, radio interviews and seen your work. I remember one of the ads which you had written, which appeared in, it was a very short-lived award ceremony, which Neil French helmed, right? With just print. I think it was something to do with mangoes, or it was tourism.
Maharashtra tourism, yes.
Maharashtra tourism, yeah. So I still remember that. Just want to turn the clock back a little, right? So just tell us a bit about your childhood and how it sort of influenced the choices you made.
So I think that so English has played a very important role in my life, in many ways more than Indian languages. And part of the reason for that is that at a very young age, my father took a job in Manchester, England. So I think I was 5 years old when I went to England, and I was put in a school, and at that time I was just about learning CAT, CAT, BAT, BAT in Calcutta in those days. And I suddenly found myself, and I still remember that, you know, there were these tables where we had like, I think, six students sitting around a table, and I just sort of sat and stared for 2 weeks because I couldn't speak. And then suddenly, you know, the words started pouring out of my mouth, and they never stopped. And I think that's the advantage of being immersed in a culture and language at a young age, that you just learn automatically. So I didn't have to make that effort. And I just developed a love for the language at that early age. In fact, just to boast a little bit about me at age six, you know, once I started reading, and I remember we had this graded series of books to read, and so that was nice about the school system, that it wasn't like the same. It was according to your aptitude level. So I finished all the possible books that were there. And then when my mom went to meet my teacher, she said, sorry, but you know, he's finished all of them, so we don't have anything more to. So yeah, so that's my bit of showing off about Sumanto age six.
So did that sort of like influence you at some point later? Because which sort of brings me to my next question. You've done an MBA. I know that advertising is a hotbed for a lot of misfits, in the sense, you know, people who've studied engineering or MBA or whatever it is, right? But what is your version? How did you do an MBA and then move?
So, you know, I really didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up. I still haven't grown up, but definitely when I was studying, I was very scared of the concept of working, and I wanted to, you know, delay that as much as possible. So I actually have two master's degrees, and you may be shocked to know that my other master's degree is in mathematics. Even I'm shocked today to think that I have a master's degree in applied mathematics. So, you know, my father taught at the Indian Institute of Management in Calcutta, and he wanted his sons to do MBAs. And because I had no clue what I wanted to do when I finished my bachelor's degree, first of all, I first did my master's in mathematics, and that's also a very peculiar story because when I was in school in Calcutta, I was struggling with mathematics. Then when I went to the States to do my bachelor's degree, I said, you know, my math teachers told me you're good at maths. So I was really surprised to hear that. And then they kept pushing me. So I ended up doing a double major in mathematics and economics at the bachelor's level. And there were these universities come recruiting. So a university called Clemson University in South Carolina came to my college, which was Berea College in Kentucky, in the deep south of the US. And they offered me basically the ability to study and finance my master's degree there. And again, I had no idea what I wanted to do in life. So I said, okay, at least it solves my problem of knowing what I'm going to do once I graduate. And so I did mathematics, and I did pretty well on it. And I think that my biggest learnings there, more than about mathematics, was I started teaching to finance my degree. And I remember that I was absolutely petrified, you know, when I had to first start teaching, because you know that a lot of American kids are really big built, and especially the ones who come on sports scholarships. So I had, and I was teaching statistics 101, and I had these students who were not that much, they were close to my age at that point in time, and there were these huge guys who were on football and baseball scholarships. And I was so nervous because I'd never taught before. And I was in front of them. I was literally sweating, you know. I mean, I wasn't even used to writing on the blackboard. And every time, you know, I'd turn my back to the class, I'd hear people snickering and people would be throwing things. And there was this one guy who was the ringleader. So I still remember that, you know, after I went through 2 or 3 weeks of this agony, and I said, you know, I can't go on like this. And after a few sleepless nights, I decided that I'm going to talk to this fellow. And, you know, I was the teacher, but it was even scary for me to tell that guy to stay back after class. So I told him, can you please stay back after class? And he looked really surprised, but he stayed back. And I said, listen, I'm teaching for the first time in my life. I'm trying my best. I may not be doing great, but I'm really trying. But you're not making it easy for me. And, you know, that was a turning point in my life, because not only did he stop the heckling and, you know, all the mischief, he became like the class monitor. And he was a football player. So if he told the class to shut up, you know, everybody behaved themselves. And, you know, he would, if anybody was, you know, creating a disturbance, he would, you know, sort of give them a stern look. And then he'd look at me like, see, it just became such a smooth process for me from there on. So I really learned that sometimes when you take the bull by the horns, it works for you. So anyway, so I did my master's degree, and then I did my MBA, because again, once I finished my master's in mathematics, I said, okay, what next? My father always has wanted his kids to do MBA, so let me do an MBA. So I applied to McGill University in Montreal, Canada, and I did my MBA there. And it was a lot of hard work. It wasn't rocket science, but honestly, I found a lot of it quite boring. But I was always this very studious kind of student, so I would do well. And so two things there. One is that the one course which I did find interesting was Advertising 101, and the part of it where we were shown these TV commercials. I said, hey, these look like fun. I wouldn't mind working on something like this. That was one part of it. The other part of it was that I sort of had realized by then that I have an aptitude for writing. So whenever we had these, we had to write a lot of research papers. Some of them were group projects, and I'd always volunteer to be the one to write it. And, you know, some of the North American students would look at me like, you know, they have the mistaken assumption that English is not our first language and you're going to write. And so it was, I remember on the first group project, they were quite hesitant. And then, you know, once they saw that I can write, so then after that, it was always understood that I'm going to be the one doing the writing. And I hated doing the research. I think that's another thing that advertising creative people always hate, research. And I hated doing the research, so I was very happy to be sitting at my computer at home or on campus and writing it up. And I didn't want to go and with questionnaires and go into retail establishment and ask customers, about things. So yeah, so that was my journey. And so, like I said, I loved the advertising course and I loved watching the ads in that class. And also during the last semester of my MBA, there was a contest. So, in Montreal is in French Canada. A lot of connections with France, and the French tourism board was running a contest where you could write a slogan for France. And I said, okay, let me write. And I just wrote something. And don't ask me because I don't remember what it is. But I won the prize. And I came. The other weird thing was that everybody, at that time, every Indian going abroad was like, the dream was that you did everything possible to stay back in that foreign country. And I always wanted to come back to India because I somehow felt that, I would truly feel at home only when I was back home. So I came back and initially I remember telling my parents, I want to take a break before I start working. And my father was like, okay, 3 months. And during that 3 months is actually when the results of this contest got announced. And this was, of course, back in the day where there was no internet, no nothing. And I got, I don't remember how I was informed that I've won this. And that the prize was to go on Bastille Day to Paris and, be a guest of honor and all that. I was really excited. And I remember that, I was visiting cousins in Madras called Chennai now. And, I heard this. I cut short my trip. I went back to Calcutta and I went to the French consulate. And they said that, normally it takes much more time to give you a visa, but we'll give it to you really quick. And then the tragedy was that there was an air traffic controller strike. So all flights got canceled. So I never went on that trip. But, but it had whetted my appetite for advertising. And I thought, hey, I can do this. And so I took up a job in advertising. After that 3 month period, which the three months which my father had allowed me not to work. So
which was your first agency?
So I was in Calcutta and there is an ad agency called Response, which was run by a gentleman called Ram Ray. Ram Ray was like a real maverick, and he was with HTA, which is now Wunderman Thompson. So he was an amazing guy. He was a suit, and he was at that time the only guy from Indian advertising who had, he headed the San Francisco office of Thompson at that time. He went to America and he headed a couple of the branches there, which was unheard of for an Indian at that time, practically in any industry, I think. So then he came back, and I believe the story that I'd heard was that he was expecting to be made the head, India head of Thompson's, and somebody else got that job. So he was furious and he just quit his job, drove out the office, and he started his own agency, which was Response. So, and like I said, he was a suit, but he taught me a lot about writing copy, because some very simple but effective lessons. One of the things was whenever I wrote something, I took it to him, he would sit and cut out every superfluous word. And he said, only when every word that can possibly be cut out without reducing the meaning, only once you've cut them all out is when your copy will really shine. And that is so true, and that's something that I follow even today. I remember once that I started a sentence with however, and he cut it out. And he said that, from overuse, the however-ness of the word however has gone. So don't use it.
So just another question. At some point, like Calcutta was a hotbed of advertising. How is it now, and what is the transition? Like, what is the change that you have seen over the years as someone who started their career in Calcutta? How is it now?
So, unfortunately, even when I started my career in advertising, Calcutta was well past its heyday, so to speak. And just because overall, there was this flight of, at one time, Calcutta was the capital and the commercial capital of India, and many of the companies had their head offices there. Because of all the labor unrest and other reasons, many of the companies relocated, or at least their Calcutta office ceased to be the most important one. And as a result, the advertising industry also stagnated. So it's quite ironical that so many of the creative people come out of Calcutta. But you know, for them to really prosper, they have to move to other agencies in other cities. So Calcutta's loss is the rest of India's gain, so to speak.
So how did you go from Response to Ogilvy Bombay?
When I joined, I knew that I wanted to move to Bombay and I wanted to move to a big agency and I wanted to move to one of the creatively well-known agencies. Of course, Response had a very good reputation in Calcutta, but it was very regional. Dabur's Nature's Care, which was this was an anti-constipation product. So but it was a very, very successful launch. And, you know, we worked on some other national brands, but by and large, it was regional stuff that we were doing. And at that time, Ogilvy was the hottest creative agency. I mean, I think in many ways it still is. But at that time, of course, there was Trikaya Grey, which was big, Rediffusion, which was big. But Ogilvy was just, you know, that's when Pante had taken over and it was really on this upward trajectory. So I just thought that, you know, let me get some experience in a boutique agency, but then I will move to a multinational agency and a multi-city agency. Probably first make the move to their office in Calcutta and then move to Bombay. And that's somebody at Ogilvy Calcutta approached me. So I took up the job. And then, you know, soon after I said, you know, I started telling people that I want to move to Bombay. I think it took like a couple of years, but I did move from Calcutta to Bombay.
Oh, okay. So you joined Ogilvy like in the early 90s, right? When it was just taking off.
It was in the mid 90s. Yeah.
Okay. Mid 90s. So when it was like just about to blow up into.
Yeah.
Right. So that was when like Indian advertising had just turned a corner. So previous eras belong to the likes of Freddie Birdie, Alok Nanda. Great English writers. Some argue that they were somewhat out of touch with the ground reality. So what they wrote was beautiful, but it was not reaching the masses. And then you had Piyush Pandey who cracked the code essentially. And here is someone like you who's done a double master's. You love English. You still love English. I'm not saying that it's gone. But you are in the hotbed of a place that is known for creating stuff, ads in Hindi and stuff, right? I mean, how did you find your place in that atmosphere?
So I guess, you know, I've always been a misfit in everything, I think. So I'm quite used to being a misfit and a bit of a rebel. But yeah, so I think that, you know, I was tolerated. I was very outspoken in my younger days and I was always getting into trouble. But I think I was tolerated and I probably did bring something to the table which sort of kept me going and which made people not sack me. And I think that the end of the day, ideas are not restricted to any one language. Even if you look at the Ogilvy network, many of the countries you have people from another country who don't speak the local language as the creative head. So I don't think that it's necessary. Yeah, I mean, of course, I think it helps. I mean, today, from the time that I joined Ogilvy to today, many of the writers today don't even speak English or don't speak much English, but they're fantastic writers in Hindi. Of course, I think that the bias now is towards, I mean, Hindi being the sort of the link language across India, like English used to be. I mean, so it's Hindi is the main language now. And of course, for somebody like me who's a Bengali, I think that I know Bengali pretty well. And I think one answer to the question you asked me is, I think that I'm not a great Bengali writer, but I have been steeped in that language and culture apart from my English side. So I think that helps me connect with the Indian masses. But yes, being a creative director, I always had a team which always included Hindi writers. So that's how I was able to make it happen in Hindi and other languages. But yeah, like I said, I think that ideas can at times be independent of language. As long as you understand the culture, understand the mindset of the people, you can appeal to it, regardless of which language you are most comfortable with.
Like each industry has turning points, right? So one of them in advertising was when TV became mainstay, you know, and that was something when you started your career. The next, it can be argued, was when digital media came to the fore. And a lot of people said, and like I was in advertising at that point, and I still remember most people didn't take it seriously. They didn't take digital seriously. They thought it was something, you know, which would come and go, and TV would still, TV is still the biggest thing, but I'm talking in terms of, you know, like you attracting talent and stuff, right? So some would argue that mainline advertising sort of missed the boat when it came to digital media. And you've also started the English Nut, right? So here's where I want to segue to, you know, what you're doing. Is that an effort for you to understand a new medium better? Because you've been schooled in print and TV, right? When you started your career, I mean, social media and all was not even a distant dream. So is the English Nut a part effort for you to understand new media better?
So, you know, I think that the way the English Nut started for me was that, you know, one is that creative people always go through these phases when, you know, nothing is getting approved by the client and you feel so frustrated. So I wanted to do something for myself. So initially, it started as some posts about the English language, which has always been a passion for me. And I remember one of my colleagues telling me that, you know, you want to go for videos because that's the future. And, you know, of course, I read a lot, and while I wasn't doing much digital, I was reading about, and I didn't, like you were saying, that a lot of people believe that it was a passing phase. I knew it wasn't. Not to say that I understood it very well, but I've also, you know, I'm also an amateur actor, and I've done stuff in front of a camera. So I think that English Nut came together as a thing which A, allowed me to do stuff about the English language, which is a passion, do something with video, which was the future, do something which involved being in front of the camera in some way. So that's my narcissistic side, I guess. So in fact, in the early stages, I did skits for the English Nut because, of course, that was before the pandemic. And I think I had a little more time initially, so I was able to put together these skits, and I, with the help of colleagues, I'd shoot them. Of course, once the lockdown started, in fact, I was technologically very backward. So, you know, I remember when the lockdown started, I said, oh my God, I've never shot any of my videos myself. So, and I spent a few sleepless nights, and I said, either I figure out how to shoot it on my phone or I have to say goodbye. And I said, no, I'm not prepared to say goodbye. So I remember I balanced my smartphone on my laptop. I used the laptop screen to angle it correctly. I put them on a pile of books, and I remember the lighting was shit, but that's how I shot my first video. So, and I think it was on the word quarantine, if I'm not wrong. So yes, I think that it was my effort to understand this whole, you know, I'm using the word video, but yes, I think social media, getting into it, understanding it from behind the scenes, the nuts and bolts of it. But frankly, the bigger reason for it was the fact that I wanted to do stuff with English, and I wanted to do stuff which puts me in front of the camera. And I think that this was a way of doing that. And social media, a media that allows anybody, you know, we're called creators today. I didn't know the word at that time, or I never heard it being applied to people like me at that time. So I became a creator. Yeah.
I think it's worked because you are one of the LinkedIn creators, right? You are in that. So for something which you started on the side, you interviewed the likes of Ruskin Bond, Shashi Tharoor. Just give us a bit of a backstory in how you sort of manage those, and, you know, like how you managed to work your way up to do those interviews.
So, you know, I remember that when some years back, I don't know if you recall that the Indian-American comedian Hasan Minhaj had done this interview of Shashi Tharoor, where he'd asked him the meanings of certain millennial terms like fleek and thick. And Shashi Tharoor, of course, wasn't able to understand any of them. And I remember a friend of mine, Anup Menon, who was at Ogilvy and then by then had joined Facebook, he said, hey, you know, you need to have your point of view on this as the English Nut. And so I just did a video where I said, dear Shashi Tharoor, I would love to interview you. And I promise you, I won't ask you questions about the sort of English that you were quizzed on by Hasan Minhaj. I'm going to ask you about the Queen's English and the English that's spoken in India today. And I'd love to interview you someday. And I just put that video on my channel. And one of my, former colleagues, a guy called Jay Morzaria, who used to be in my team actually at one point in time, and he got in touch and he said, you know, Shwanta, every year I like to do a video as my personal project. Like, he had done a video interview with Piyush Pandey as one of his personal projects. He's also done a beautiful one which was a surprise for his father. So anyway, he'd done these videos and he said that, can I, you know, help you make this Shashi Tharoor interview a reality? I said, sure. And he's one of the most enthusiastic guys that I know. And he was relentless in finding out, you know, contact details of Shashi Tharoor's managers and so on and so forth. And of course, I said, look, I'll word the email and all of that. But, you know, we kept getting passed on from one person to another and another. And, you know, nothing was happening. And eventually, one of the managers that Jay got in touch with said that, you know, I'll give you a day. And so there was another colleague of mine, Priyam Bengali, who's not a Bengali, he's a Gujarati, but with a surname Bengali, who was anyway helping me. He was directing and shooting some of my videos. So we decided that we'll do this together on a shoestring budget, because I'm the typical creative person who's lousy at monetizing anything. So I've really spent money on the English Nut. I've earned so little that, you know, it's not worth talking about. So anyway, so we booked, you know, tickets to go early morning one day, and we'd been given a time of, I think, 5 p.m. So we'll shoot it and then we'll take the late night flight back. And I was so nervous because I thought, you know, Shashi Tharoor is a member of parliament. What if, you know, a crisis comes up? You know, he's an important person with important things. And he doesn't. And also, you know, maybe his manager hasn't communicated. So all these thoughts were going through my head. And I remember that there was a literary fest. I think the Tata Literary Fest that was happening a few weeks before the date that we'd been given. And I said, okay, I'm going to go and try and meet him at this fest. And, you know, I've not been the kind of person who goes out and, you know, walks up to people in public places. And I'd never done that. And I never could do that for Shumanto. But I realized that the English Nut gave me a new identity, which allowed me to do things, crazy things, which I've never done before. So I remember, and I think the opening panel discussion featured him. So I went and I sat in the auditorium, and I was whatever, the 20th row or something like that at NCPA. And, you know, he arrived a few minutes before the thing, and he was standing in front of the stage talking to a couple of people, and I said, here's my chance. So I literally jumped over all the rows of seats and I went and said, hi, you know, I'm Shumanto, I'm the English Nut. And he stared blankly at me. So I said, you know, I've been given an appointment by your manager to come and interview. He said, oh, really? About what? So I was getting really panicked. I said, about the English language. So I said, okay. And that was it. You know, then he turned to another person. And so then I sat through the panel discussion. And then they announced that there was going to be a book signing. So I quickly went and bought a couple of his books and stood in the queue. And there was somebody who was, you know, saying, okay, to what name do you want the book to be dedicated? So I had bought two books. So on one of them, I asked them to put Shumanto, and on the other one, The English Nut. And then I reached, by the time the queue, I got to him in the queue. And he wrote, he inscribed the books. I realized from what he'd written that by then he'd either, you know, checked his emails or whatever, because he said, you know, he wrote something about the English Nut, and he said, looking forward to talking to you and stuff like that. So I was really relieved, you know, that I was a lot more confident that when I got to Delhi, I would actually be able to interview. So yeah, so that's how that happened. And, you know, once I met him, so of course, I was really, really nervous at the start. And I remember he walked into the room and he said, I've just got 20 minutes. And we'd been promised an hour by his manager. And I had all these printouts of my questions. And, you know, I literally, like, I was fumbling with them and they all fell down, because I was saying, okay, if I have only got 20 minutes, what are my most important questions? So anyway, but once he started, and once we started and he warmed up and he realized that, you know, I wasn't a complete idiot who was there to ask him some stupid question. He became really nice. He answered all my questions and he gave me all the time that I wanted. So it was a fantastic experience.
That's quite a journey too. But I'm sure it must have been worth it. And what about Ruskin Bond? How did that happen?
So Ruskin Bond again happened, I think, in some ways because of the Shashi Tharoor interview. So again, one of my former colleagues, a guy called Jeetu, Jitendra Patel, he left Ogilvy and he became a freelancer. He does all sorts of things. He creates, he designs installations. He does graphic design. Ruskin Bond's grandson, Siddharth Bond, has started something called the Ruskin Bond Collections. And he somehow knew Jeetu, former colleague and friend of mine, and got him to start designing some stuff, the logo and other things for the Ruskin Bond Correct. And Jitu, of course, was aware of the English Nut and Shashi Tharoor. He thought that, you know, it would be a good idea for me to interview Ruskin Bond. And I think he told Siddharth about it and showed Siddharth the Shashi Tharoor interview. And so Siddharth got really excited. And so anyway, then Jitu sent me a message saying, would you like to interview Ruskin Bond? I said, yes, of course. And then, you know, we did a call with Siddharth Bond. And, you know, I'm not somebody, you know, who hero worships people and, you know, I don't have fanboy moments. But when I was on that call and suddenly Jitu asked Siddharth, is Dadaji around? So he said, yes, he's here. And suddenly I heard, you know, that familiar voice on the phone. And I was so excited, you know, I said, I'm so excited to talk to you, Mr. Bond, and all that. And, you know, here, and by then I'd already thoroughly, I'd prepared my questions. Because one thing is, you know, I've realized is when you do interviews, and not that I've done that many, but you've got to ask questions which they've not been asked a million times before. So, you know, I go through all their interviews and then I try to come up with questions. And of course, you have to be, you know, you have to have read all their books, or at least a lot of their books. So, you know, you're not just doing this superficially. So I'd already done that. I had prepared my questionnaire. So I told him, you know, these are the kind of questions that I want to ask you. And he loves food. So I told him the food related. So he was quite excited about it. And then we said, okay, let's fix a date and do this. And I said that let's not wait till winter, because, you know, I have this fear of flights getting cancelled and things like that. And again, you know, you don't go with a lot of, you know, I'm doing this on top of my full-time job. So I can't just go there for a week and, you know, wait. So I was there. I was going with one day and an extra day's buffer just in case something went wrong. But anyway, I went. And in fact, Jitu and his team shot the video for me, and I met Siddharth and I met Mr. Bond, and it was just he was so warm and wonderful. And, you know, in fact, his grandson said that, you know, maybe he need to take breaks to rest and this and that, but, you know, he was just, I think he was raring to go, and he said, no, let's finish it in one go. In fact we took a break for lunch, which he did. He said, no, let's finish it. But, you know, everyone said, no, let's have lunch and then finish it. But and it's just amazing that at his age, you know, his memory is so strong. And, you know, you ask him about a book or an author, and he'll talk about it with the year and that, you know, all of that. So it was really, really wonderful too.
That's nice. So two things, right? Like, I'm just saying two things you've said. One is, you said you're an eternal rebel, right? You've always been an outlaw or something. And you've also done two masters. So, you know, so those are a bit like anticlimactic, right? So the English Nut as an entity, right? You are also sort of educating people. I'm not saying it's an educational channel, but you are talking sense. For a moment, I just want you to remove your advertising CD hat and put on a teacher's hat. If you were given the chance, how would you make education more fun for generations or for the next generation?
So I think, you know, to start with, teachers have to be paid a lot more. I think that things are not going to improve while teachers are so poorly paid. In fact, you know, I watched the Ellen show, you know, Ellen DeGeneres, her shows, and on a lot of her shows, she invites teachers, especially teachers from underprivileged communities, and, you know, some of them are doing really inspiring work in America. And it's only, of course, they're very ill paid, and she gets them millions of dollars at times, or at least thousands of dollars to help, because a lot of times these teachers are paying out of their pocket. But, you know, I think that these teachers are so passionate about their students. Some of their students come, you know, they don't have parents, they don't have somebody to drive them to a soccer or football match. So these teachers will double up as their parents. You know, they will provide things for those students. So I think that, you know, of course, that kind of love and passion is, it's not that every teacher is going to be born with that degree of devotion. But I think that if teachers were better paid, they could be a lot more creative in the way that they do a job. Or let's say many more creative people would be attracted to that profession. Today, I think a lot of talented people do not go into that profession because it's ill paid. And I think that because of that, primary, secondary education suffers in our country, not in our country, just in our country, but even in a country like America. And I think that ultimately in every profession, it's creativity which makes the difference. So if the teacher is creative in the way that he or she teaches, then I think the students are going to learn a lot more and a lot better. And I think also the tremendous pressure that we have in our country to do well, to get high marks is also something that, you know, needs to go. But I think it's a factor of how our economy is, because of course, it's a lot better now than it was in our time. But I think because the number of jobs is limited, so therefore, every parent wants to prepare their child to be able to get, you know, one of those jobs, especially in the coveted professions. But yeah, today, I think there are a lot more professions, a lot more avenues available. So that I think that makes it better. In terms of the approach, I think it needs to be a little more, especially at the early stages, a little more unstructured. I'll talk a little bit about the schools that I went to. So when I was in Kolkata, I went to a school called Pathobhavan. It was a very Bengali-oriented school. Pathobhavan is the name of Tagore School in Shantiniketan. So this is not affiliated to that, but this was a school that was created in Calcutta based on the same model. So there was a big emphasis on the arts, culture. You know, we spent a lot of time drawing. We would put together plays. We had these Sahitya Sabhas at the end of every term where, you know, you would recite a poem or you would do a skit or you would, you know, you'd put up your art. So I think that has always stayed with me, you know. That's where I think I started. The first piece of writing that I did was for one of the Sahitya Sabhas, where I wrote a piece about a place that I traveled to, and that was put up on the wall. And I think those things make such a difference, you know. I had some wonderful teachers, and I think that it's wonderful teachers who are passionate about what they do, who are creative in the way that they teach, that really make a difference. And I think that every successful, famous person that you talk to, you'll probably find at least one such teacher in their lives. So I think that's what really needs to change. And of course, the education sector is changing a lot, and I think that private players, these startups, these app-based educators are coming up in a big way. I think they're trying to fill the gap, so which is important, and especially for places, you know, tier 2, tier 3 towns, and, you know, more remote places where they may not have access to the best education. It's wonderful to have the online avenue. In fact, I think for me, YouTube has been the biggest teacher, because everything that I want to learn, I go and search for it on YouTube, and there are so many, and even like the nuts and bolts of how to create a video for the English nut, there's so much that YouTube has helped me with.
I just want to add to what you said, right? You've spoken about being creative. Another thing which I think, especially like in a country like India, every parent aspires for their child to go to an quote-unquote English medium school, right? Because that is the ticket to a successful life or career or whatever it is, right? And at the same time, you work in advertising. You've seen a different kind of shift where it has gone from English to regional language. You work with people who are brilliant in regional language, but not so good in English. Do you still think that English is the key to a successful career, or is it an outdated notion? I'm not saying you should not study English or know English, but is that still relevant? Say, for example, a lot of TikTok stars came from tier 2, tier 3, tier 4, right? And they suddenly got a platform to showcase their skills without all these superfluous things of, you know, being good in English and stuff. I just wanted to know your take on that.
Yeah. So I think there's quite a dichotomy. So if you look at the corporate world, even an ad agency, even though, you know, you need to be really strong in the regional languages or in Hindi or whatever, I think knowing English helps, because when you go to meet a client and you have to present to the client, if you can't speak English at all, that's going to be detrimental. Of course, the way, again, everything is teamwork, so there always has to be, you know, that one person holding it together. And though, of course, nowadays I do attend meetings where a lot of the time Hindi is being spoken, or in Calcutta, Bengali is being spoken. But I don't think that English is going to lose its relevance. And in fact, you talk about TikTok stars, even Bollywood stars, some of them, when they came in, they didn't know English at all, and they have made a huge effort to learn English or improve their English, because somehow English becomes the gatekeeper. And I'm not saying that's right, but it does, English still opens doors. The biggest thing that you see is that politicians who are always saying that, you know, Indian languages, they send their kids to the best English medium schools. So I'm not passing any judgment on what's right or what's wrong, but I think that English is a beautiful language. I think I consider it as one of India's languages. And I don't think that people should be discriminated against because they don't know English well. But the reality is that English is going to keep opening doors for people for a long time to come. Whether it's Indians who are playing in the global arena or even within India. I mean, I think there are certain industries like you talked about, the film industry. Of course, how good your Hindi is or your Bengali or whichever language films you're doing is the most important. But I think even till you've really established yourself, you know, to be able to introduce yourself in English counts for something, even for people like that.
So there is also another side to Sumanto, which is your acting side. I'm not talking about the acting you do on English Nut. You've actually acted, like maybe not massive roles, but you know, you've been a part of Bollywood in some way. The usual transition is writers go on to become directors, say the likes of Balki or whatever it is, right? But you are an actor. You prefer to be in front of the camera as opposed to being behind the camera. So is there any reason why you've not jumped full-fledged into being an actor?
So, you know, I have done some acting on and off over the years. And, I've also played main roles, not in mainstream commercial Bollywood movies, but I have, for example, in art films. In fact, the first major role that I had was in a Hindi art film called Char Adhyay, which was directed by Kumar Shani, and it was based on Tagore's novella called Char Adhyay. And it was in Hindi, which was a challenge for me because my Hindi is not that great. It's a lot better today than it was in the early days, because spending a lot of my time, even in my schooling, first of all, my schooling was in Calcutta and we only had Hindi at a much later stage. And even during those years, I went abroad again. You know, we didn't only go. My father didn't only take a job in England. Later on, he took a job in Tanzania, Arusha, Tanzania as well. So I didn't get to learn much Hindi at all. And, you know, if you know anything about Calcutta, there's not much emphasis on. In those days, there was even less so. So that I think was a disadvantage for me, knowing Hindi. But coming back to the topic, yes, I've done a major role in a Hindi film called Char Adhyay. You can catch me in a pretty significant role in Bengali on an art film called Jonaki. But that Jonaki is, again, it's an art film with, there's very little dialogue. It's all in the visuals, and it's, every frame is like a painting. It's really, really beautiful. So you should catch it on Netflix if you can. Decided a few years ago. And I've done some experimental films in English directed by a lady called Shom Shukla Das. And, you know, I got nominated for some Best Actor awards in Europe for those, which I was thrilled about. And again, those were in main roles. One film was called White Bee. Another film was called Murals. What gets me recognition mostly is, you know, my 15 seconds of fame in Piku, which is, of course, a Bollywood hit directed by my friend Shujit Sarkar. And Juhi Chaturvedi, who wrote it, is also a former colleague and friend. And I think she thought of me for this little role where they're trying to, Mausumi Chatterjee is trying to matchmake between this guy and Deepika Padukone. And so I have this scene with Amitabh Bachchan and Deepika. And I remember being really nervous when I suddenly found myself in front of Amitabh Bachchan. And I had these really weird sensations in my stomach. But, you know, we did and then Amitabh Bachchan likes to rehearse his scene. So I think by the time we finished a couple of rehearsals, you know, the fluttering in my stomach had gone down and I was able to do that well. And so even today on the English Nut, I often get comments, weren't you in Piku? So, yeah, I think your initial question was that why haven't you done more? And I think it's because for me, advertising was my primary career. And I'm not somebody who can, you know, like say, okay, I'm just going to chuck up my job and try this. But I think today I've reached a point where I've done, I've been there, done that. And I want to explore acting a lot more. In fact, quite recently, I did an acting workshop. There's something called the Eric Morris system, which is like a method acting system by this very famous acting coach in America called Eric Morris. And one of his students, Benny, did a workshop in Bombay. I attended that. And I'm planning to attend another acting workshop pretty soon at Adi Shakti. So, yeah. So I think that I want to take my acting a lot more seriously. I want to hone my skills. And so after that, if directors will have me, then I will do more acting.
I guess you're on the cusp, but let's just wait for the full-fledged jump to happen. I don't like to use the word advice because like I find it, you know, too preachy. But of course, you are someone who has to pass comment on ideas and scripts day in and day out, right? Like as a day job. What would you tell a young, I won't say young creative, I would say a young creator to get better at what they do?
So, you know, I can only talk about things from what I've learned for myself as a creator. And, you know, so and maybe I'm not the ideal person to give advice because I see a lot of creators, you know, they study that. And I'm from advertising. I'm supposed to study my target audience and, you know, then put out something that they want. To give you an example, when I started the English Nut and I was taking the advice of some people who are experts, and they were saying that, you know, you need to basically dumb down your content. And if you start doing stuff which is the absolute basic level of people who don't know or who know very little English, and you're doing stuff for them, that's going to be a lot more help. That's going to get you a lot more numbers. But I just didn't want to do that because for me, English Nut was about, I have to enjoy doing it. Every video, I put a lot of work into researching every video that I create. I put a lot of effort into it. So it has to be something that I love. And, you know, this actually goes against all marketing concepts. You know, they used to say that back in the day that, you know, you can't build a better mousetrap and expect people to come and, you know, just find it. You have to advertise it and so on and so forth. But I think that my hope is that, you know, you just improve your craft of what you're doing, make it perfect, put something out there which is useful to somebody. Now, again, if you look at the most successful channels, there's nothing, they're completely mindless, right? And they're the ones who have the maximum numbers. But I believe that I want to, at least I want to do something which is going to be meaningful to somebody out there, not just, you know, something that you just, you know, have a laugh at and forget about. And you like it and you know it's liked by 60 million people, but it didn't really create any value. So I think that being a creator should be about creating value. And it should be, do something that you're passionate about, because that's the only way you can keep doing it. Because it's a lot of hard work, trust me. I mean, creators go bonkers, and I'm doing the English Nut on top of a full-time job, so it's really hard. But even I've talked to creators like, you know, we had a LinkedIn creators meet, which was the first time that I was exposed to other creators, which is a wonderful thing. And, you know, they were saying that, you know, it's going to, you know, one of the creators said that, you know, I never do more than one post a day, but I see people doing 5 posts a day. And I think that will lead to serious mental health issues. And I tend to agree. You know, you can go completely nuts trying to constantly grow your numbers and constantly appeal to more and more people. So I think that, you know, do what you really believe in. Do what you love and keep improving your craft and make it perfect. So that's what I would say, you know.
What is the difference as someone, you straddle two worlds, right? I mean, you are a creative person. On one hand, you work on very tight briefs and deadlines in the sense that, you know, you are expected to meet a certain objective. On the other hand, with English Nut, you can go a bit crazy. You can sort of push the boundaries a lot more. How do you shift your headspace between the two? And what are the main differences you feel when you sit down to crack a campaign and crack the next episode of the English Nut?
So it is very different. So one of the reasons that I started the English Nut was because I was frustrated at times with, you know, the typical creative anguish of why clients won't buy my best ideas. So I said that let me do something where I get to choose what I put out there. And so I think it's about what I'm going to enjoy writing, what I'm going to enjoy shooting, what I consider worthwhile. So I think that's one thing versus when you're doing something for the client. Of course, even there, you have to do something which you consider worthwhile, but it has to intersect with what the client considers worthwhile. So I think that's one big difference. The other thing is that, you know, to let you in on something, I'm also working on a book, which actually a publisher approached me based on seeing what I'm doing on the English Nut. So because I don't have unlimited amount of time, a lot of what I'm putting into my videos right now is based on the research that I'm doing for the book. So which is, in a way, it's limiting me to the kind of subjects that I'm tackling in the English Nut. But again, I have the freedom to do that because it's my own channel, right? But once I finish writing the book, I'll be able to you know, delve into other topics as well. Not that every single episode is based on what I'm researching for the book. That's not true. I mean, just take the Ruskin Bond interview, for example. That has nothing to do with my book. And even the other stuff, sometimes, you know, there'll be a topic. And the topics come to me, you know, it's just during the course of the day, I'll be talking to somebody and, you know, they make a mistake or I see something written incorrectly on a wall. Or it could be just be a word that I come across in a book that I'm reading and I just make a note of that in a Word document that I have for the English Nerd. And then, you know, I go back to it at some point and I do a solid amount of research. And one part which is similar to advertising is, so I promised myself when I started the English Nerd that I would put out one video every single Sunday. And I've been able to stick to that for like 3 years. And so which means that I have these tight deadlines. Every week I have to research and write a script and then shoot it, you know. So that part of it, that my advertising training has really helped me in that.
So when do you typically do your research? I mean, I presume that your day goes in meetings and more meetings. When do you actually find time to sit down and do the research?
So one is I don't have weekends. You know, I'm working 7 days a week. Sunday, I don't get to sleep in on Sunday because, you know, that's when I upload. Of course, I upload my videos ahead of time on Facebook and Instagram and so on and so forth. But I still need to get up in the morning and check that everything is, because there are times when glitches happen and your video doesn't, you know, play properly or something like that. So I have to be up to check on all of that. Then I also share them on some other platforms, on my blog and all. Then I do that once it's come out. So that's something that I do on Sunday. I also try to shoot a video like on a Saturday. And I, you know, then I work on editing it and all of that starts from Sunday to be ready for the following weekend because I upload. So yeah, so that's how it goes. So my evenings after work or whenever I have time, I'm, you know, working on the English Nerd.
I've seen that you've written forwards for books. It's nice to see that now you're sort of actually writing your own book. Three books that have really influenced you.
A couple of authors that inspired me, were the Indian authors who wrote in English because I think it made me see that maybe I didn't think that I would be writing a book ever, but it made me see that, you know, you can be a brilliant writer in English and not, and be from India. So I think Salman Rushdie and Midnight's Children was the first book that inspired me in that way. And what I just loved about the book was the fact that its use of language, because, you know, Salman Rushdie used, you know, sort of his own brand of Indian English. The way the character spoke was just, you know, it was absolutely endearing and wonderful. And I think that's what made his, one of the things that made his book stand out so much, and, you know, it went on to become a bestseller and won so many awards and made him so famous worldwide. So yeah, Midnight's Children is one of them. Two other Indian English authors that have inspired me, one of them is Vikram Seth and the other one is Amitav Ghosh. Vikram Seth, I actually, true confession, I've not read A Suitable Boy. I'm very scared of very thick books. So I haven't read that one, but I've read his other books, and two of his books which I absolutely love are a book called Unequal Music, which is about a violinist, and it's just absolutely beautiful. And the other one is The Golden Gate, which is a novel written in verse. It's written in iambic tetrameter. And you'd think that a novel written in verse would be something which is really difficult to read, but it's such a breezy and delightful read. I would recommend it to everybody. You know, you don't have to be a great reader of books, or you don't have to know fantastic English to be able to read it. It's just delightful. And the other one, the third one, is Amitav Ghosh. I've been reading his books over the years. I think most recently it was the Ibis trilogy. And again, I mean, he's just a fantastic writer, and he does a lot of research for his books. He usually picks the sort of period stories in that sense, and based on his, there's a lot of historical facts mixed with his fiction. So it was the Opium Wars in the Ibis trilogy, for example. And so one of the languages that some of his dialogues are in those books is Pidgin English. So it was quite fascinating to see Pidgin. And Pidgin English was a sort of a language that developed aboard ships, among other places, because there were these people from different parts of Asia, you know, who had to communicate with each other. So, you know, they just used this kind of. So I love his books. One of his less famous books is the Calcutta Chromosome, which is a science fiction book, which is a genre which he's, I think that's the only book he's written. But that's also historical in the sense that that's based loosely on this guy called Ross, who sort of, I think, was one of the major people behind coming up with the vaccine or treatment for malaria. So isolating, you know, or figuring out, you know, how malaria is transmitted to start with. But the book is very futuristic and it's science fiction in that sense. Then the Glass Palace, the Shadow Lines, which is about communalism, which is to me such a terrible thing that, you know, that has reared its ugly head in India over and over again over the decades. But I think it's right now also it's at a peak. So
A Suitable Boy also sits in my bookshelf. I think my sister bought it, I think, in 2005. I've not opened it because, like you, given the limited time, I think I'll spend the next 15 years, you know, just reading it. Just want to end with, okay, the show is called Coffee by Two. Is Sumanto a tea or a coffee person, or is it something else?
Okay, just one correction. It's Sumanto.
Sumanto, sorry. Okay, is Sumanto a tea, coffee, or is it entirely something else?
Being a good bong, I love good tea. You know, I've grown up drinking very good Darjeeling tea in Calcutta. But I'm a coffee addict. In Bombay, I drink coffee most of the time. When I get up in the morning, I'm just waiting for that first cup. You know, I've been told that it's not good for health to drink coffee as soon as you wake up. So I delay my first cup. But, you know, I have that espresso machine. And my first cup of coffee, I make myself in that espresso machine. And I used to drink like 7-8 cups of coffee at one time, which was not good for my sleep at all. And then I've cut back. So I only drink coffee, you know, in the first half of the day. I drink like, you know, 2-3 cups of coffee. And I hate instant coffee. So it has to be real coffee. And it's black coffee without sugar. So it's the real thing.
I can relate when you say you don't like instant coffee. But yeah, I sort of drink coffee without sugar. But it's strong coffee which you get in Bangalore, right? But it has milk. So thanks so much, Sumanto, for, I think, firstly making time on a Sunday. And it's, even from my perspective, it's very heartening to see a senior ad professional who's breaking new ground in with what you're doing, right? Like with the English Nut, because you don't see that often. Someone who's trying to, you know, explore new things and actually try it instead of, you know, from your vantage point, it's very easy to give directions, right? In the sense, you do this, right? I mean, you are in that position, but I think with English Nut, you sort of go back to becoming a junior copywriter where, you know, it's your thing, you know?
You know, I think that you have to keep learning, you have to keep exploring new things, otherwise you become stale. At least that's the way for me. I have to keep exploring different avenues of creativity. I mean, like you were talking about acting earlier, I love to do amateur photography. I mean, I want to do as many creative things as possible and I want to keep learning. I hope that's something that I keep doing forever.
That's nice to hear. Thanks, Sumanto.
Okay, thanks for that.
You can check out the show notes for the show at thecoffeeby2podcast.wordpress.com, where I write about my guests. You can leave your feedback for the show on any platform where you listen to this podcast. Thanks for stopping by for some coffee.